recording started, this is the impact of the new GTLDs.
Well, good morning. My name is Marie-Laure Lemineur. I'm with the Executive Committee of NPOC, and I'll be the moderator today for this session. We're going to discuss the issue of the impact of new GTLDs on NGOs, and basically I would like to welcome everybody. Thank the distinguished speakers for accepting our invitation. And what we want to do today is really to discuss the issue of the impact of new GTLDs on NGOs from different angles. Basically, that's why we invited the panel of experts we have today, the angle, the legal angle, from the NGOs' point of view, from the point of view of registries. So, and the private sector. So what we'll be doing is I'm going to introduce each of the speakers very briefly. You all have very extensive biographies and a lot of experience, so please forgive me if I'm very brief, because for the sake of time, I won't be able to read the whole biography. Brian is the CEO of the Public Interest Registry, and among other things, also the chair of the ATRT2 team. And Edmund is the CEO of Dot Asia and also the head of the secretariat for the Regional Internet Governance Forum, among other things. Anthony Harris has 40 years of experience in the international telecommunication carrier sector. He's the founder of many entities in Latin America, the executive director of the Argentinian Internet Association. And on my right side, we have Zaid Jamil, who is a senior partner of Jamil & Jamil Barristers at Law, and also counsel to the Cybercrime Initiative, Commonwealth Initiative. And also Klaus Stoll. Klaus is a member of NPOC, of the Executive Committee. He's also the Executive Director of the Global Knowledge Partnership Foundation, which is a multi-stakeholder coalition of organizations of all sorts. It includes Microsoft, the ITU, and NGOs. And they all gathered around the issue of ICT and development. So we might want to start with Anthony, because Anthony has excused himself. He has to go away at 9:30, so he'll be the first one to speak. Then Klaus will be speaking. That would be the speaking order. Then we can go on with Brian, if it's okay with Brian, and then Edmund, and we can finish with Zaid. So Anthony, I'll pass on the mic to you.
Thank you, Marie-Laure. I just love the way she says her name. I wish I could say it the same way with that excellent French. Good morning, everybody. I've been introduced, so I won't reintroduce myself. We're here to talk about the impact of new GTLDs on NGOs. Can somebody flip the... Alain? To the next slide, please. First of all, I would like to say, just for the record, because I'm sure you'll realize anyhow, that I am an applicant for a new GTLD. I'm a fan of the new GTLD program. And if that comes out in what I'm going to say, well, be prepared. Sooner than talk about impact, I rather look on this program as being a benefit in the case of NGOs. We see all over the world there are more internet users constantly coming into the internet. Bandwidth demand is going through the roof. I can tell you that for a fact because my day job is setting up internet exchanges in South America, and we're just doing, you know, we just can't keep up with it. And internet exchanges are what those nodes where you interchange, particularly domestic internet traffic. The IP address space with IPv6 has expanded immeasurably. I don't know how many times you multiply it. It's staggering when somebody explained to me how many IP addresses you can actually assign with IPv6. because as you all know, IPv4 is completely, almost completely depleted. The mobile internet access, in my opinion, will explode with the G4 infrastructure. I think we haven't even seen that take off yet, but it's going to be amazing because of the amount of people who have cell phones and handsets. So why is there such a concern about new GTLDs? I mean, we've gone through, I think, 5 years of battles and discussions in the ICANN with a lot of, I think everybody had a valid view on it. But my point is everything is growing in the internet, but domain names were always those 21 that we had 5 years ago and which are now fortunately expanding. I see the next one, please. I think to get to the point of NGOs specifically, and I apologize for the introduction, it was just something I'd like to say. I could use Argentina as an example, basically because my entity in Argentina is going to become a registrar soon. We're in the process of negotiating that. So we have been looking at the way Argentina internet users behave as far as registrations. One of the things we did was specifically we ran a study on 50 NGOs in Argentina to ask them, you know, what domain name were they using, why they chose it, and it was quite interesting actually because they were all, practically all of them were small or medium NGOs. They were very surprised at receiving a call on this. It's completely removed from their day business. Because they're NGOs that are helping people, or helping battered women, or you know, families, or people who are hungry, all that kind of stuff. So you don't usually find them very technically proficient to begin with. It takes some explaining so that they understand exactly what you're referring to. And usually they have some young guy he's probably the boyfriend of the secretary, and he's sort of taking care of setting up their website. And he's registered a domain name for them. The domain names, most of them are on the CCTLD, at least in Argentina, because they do want to have, or at least they have favored the concept of having a national identity with their NGO. And basically, I think because that's all, they don't know there's anything else around except .com. So we found that many of them had registered amazingly in their NGO name, which could be Familia, for example, for family, .com.ar. They hadn't even got to the, it could be .org.ar. Those that had a little more sophisticated knowledge, who were a little larger entities, some of them had directly a .org. And that sends you a message that they have looked around and they have somebody a little more technically aware. Can we see the next slide, please? And basically, thinking back on why do I think this is an opportunity for NGOs? Well, we have some examples up on the screen there. I've taken them from this 1,930 applications. And most of these names could be used as a GTLD by an NGO because they're specific perhaps to what they do on their daily activities. Like, you know, if they're lawyers, they've got law in English, they've got abogado in Spanish, or you see doctor and medical or med for the if they're in the health business or activities. And you've got sports names and all kinds of things there. So NGOs will have more options if they want to register a domain or change the domain they have. And I think that's basically going to take creating awareness. It's going to take outreach. And it's going to be quite a job. I have highlighted as most attractive .ngo and .ong because we did ask them specifically if that was interesting to them because, of course, that's their name. That identifies what they are. And amazingly, most of them were extremely interested. Because they said, oh, I can have something as specific as that. And I said, yeah, well if it gets through, you know, if the application is approved and that goes becomes available, there's no reason why not. So that was rather interesting. Can I see the next slide, please? Oh, it's thank you. okay, so I was going to say something about what have you my notes about the concerns, but I know there are people at the table who will address that the let's say the downside of the program eventually, but I don't really see. First of all, this is a favorite catchphrase of mine. The new GTLD program is not the mother of all evils, by any means. I do think that one cause of concern would be identity theft, but that's probably valid for everybody in this room and outside the room, because any of us could have a bank account hacked, or if we're careless and in some manner, we could really be damaged in the online activities. I'm scared of having a Facebook myself. I wouldn't have a Facebook telling people who I am and what I like to do. I mean, I'm sorry, but that's my private business. And then I think also when we think about those concerns of identity theft, I do remember there was some comments way back from the Red Cross about when they run a donations collection. There are attempts to hack into that and get people to send the donations to the wrong place. That's true. That is around. But that would never happen to the vast majority, at least to these NGOs that I talk to. They would never do something on that scale. It's not what they would be up to. So I don't think the scale of damage on that front would be all that immense. And then can't read this. What does it say here? Oh, yes. I don't think also that they would feel obliged to undertake defensive registrations unless they were a very big NGO, because most of them operate nationally, and I would say even within the country, they operate in a very small area, specific to a city or even a district. So those are my thoughts on the downside of this. And I think now I'll shut up because there are people who have much more interesting things to say at the table. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Anthony. Very interesting. Yes, of course. Thank you for coming in. Klaus, if you want to proceed ahead. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Klaus Stoll for the record. I actually was starting to panic when Tony pulled up the second slide, because the title of my presentation is basically Opportunities. And I really think that the new GTLDs are huge, huge opportunities for the NGO or not-for-profit sector. And let me just go through some of the opportunities. One of the opportunity is basically with the creation of .ngo and .ong, we are becoming available and online a huge, huge tool for these NGOs. And not only tool for outreach, impact, community building and all that stuff. And I know, for example, that Brian is very much concerned about how do we know that this is really an NGO and things like that. This concern is absolutely right, and there will be a solution found. I'm thinking also on the other way round, not only that the consumer or the user of the internet knows it as it does NGO, but that the NGOs know with whom they can do business and how to get into business. And one of the and that brings me to another opportunity I see, for example, is that And I'm sure that .ngo has looked into it, that already is, for example, the cross-sexual potential of the nude NGOs. Now, to do corporate social responsibility with an NGO for .com is very, very difficult. If you have a platform like .ngo, and you can really evaluate, you can talk, you can communicate, just imagine how significant that is for the whole NGO, ONG sector. There are so many facets behind that .ngo which are just fascinating, and I think we're just starting to explore them. And it's not because I like .org or because I had some past affiliation as a part of the advisory board, but on the other hand, it's also that .org is .ngo is a huge opportunity because we are dealing with a trusted and tried and tested partner. Just imagine that important NGO would have gone to somebody who has no idea how to run it. And that is also a huge, huge opportunity because we are going in all feeds running. That's basically for the NGOs who don't want to go into the adventure of getting their own GTLDs. But let's talk about a step further. I think there's also huge, huge opportunity for NGOs to, in the second, third, and hopefully more rounds, if they happen. But I'm always thinking, maybe I'm thinking wrong, is the first round failed if we don't have a second and a third round. Because then something went wrong in the first round. So let's take it, there is a second round. And I think there are huge opportunities for NGOs to really go for GTLDs, because GTLDs are community builders. Basically, whatever you do, you create with a GTLD, you create a community. And if you have, for example, a GTLD, and I don't want to give an example, a concrete example, but just imagine an NGO has a nice community and gives it a nice GTLD name. There are opportunities for targeted outreach, for increased impact, all these things. I mean, being part of the digital world, reaching everything through the mobile phone, we don't have to go there. But what is a game changer is, for example, is a part of sustainability. And that one went wrong in the first round with the GTLDs, and people said, oh, look, there are only 26 applications from Africa for a new GTLD. Yeah, what did you expect? Do you think Africa is swimming in money and can do these things on their own? What was missing was a business model. For somebody to enter the process, or for the NGO to enter a process to get a new GTLD or to apply for a GTLD, you need a business plan. And the business plan for NGOs, for specific NGOs, is community building and to sell not the GTLD to get the 99 cents or the 9.99 or 29.99 for the user, but the services, the community around it. There are real business opportunities. That brings me to the last part of what I'm trying to say is, but who is going to tell them that these opportunities exist? And I think we really should think on all fronts more about telling the general public about the significance of the new GTLDs and of internet governance. We can't expect anybody to understand what's going on in ICANN, but we can, through good narratives and things like that, find instruments to tell the general public what it means. Somebody said the easiest way to educate the general public about internet governance is to make an announcement in the BBC that by 12 o'clock next morning the internet doesn't work anymore. Suddenly it becomes interesting. We have to find ways to do that. Two things I just want to quickly talk about. as this is an NPOC event, and NPOC is working very GKPF, and I'm sorry about the people who have to listen to it the third or fourth time. We're having two initiatives to do the how-to. One initiative is quite simply called iInform. And what we're getting together this year in The Hague, in Geneva, and in an event in Africa, is the people who are quite simply interested in reaching and making the outreach to the general public and getting out the message. And one of the plans, and we're in preliminary talks, but it seems to be actually going the direction, is, for example, to do a series with the BBC in Al Jazeera of a half a minute like this in the context of their series Click. Click Online, is, and to tell the story. So what happens, one of the stories is quite simply, what happens if you access certain pages on your mobile phone? What's actually happened? What's behind it? Everybody's using it, but nobody knows it. But it's just one example. The other one is quite simply, we need to get applicants for the second round. We need NGO or not-for-profit applicants for the second round. And if we don't explain the opportunity, and if we don't explain at the same time the business model behind it, we won't get them. So we are hoping that also in the second week of October, I think we will have an event getting just simply 100 entrepreneurs together in Africa, explaining these two things and hoping that they take the message and that we have some applicants in the second round. That's all. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Klaus. Brian?
Thank you, Marie-Laure. This is Brian Cute with Public Interest Registry, and I'd like to pick up on some of Klaus's and Tony's points in my discussion. And for those of you in the room who may have heard some of this yesterday, I apologize for hearing some of it a second time, but Public Interest Registry has applied for .ngo and .ong. We're going to be offering those as community-based TLDs and as closed TLDs, so that only NGOs will be able to register a .ngo or .ong. And as Klaus said at the outset, one of the things we're working hard on is the basis or the mechanisms that we will use to have a verification in place. We've learned a lot of lessons along the way interacting robustly with the NGO community over a two-year period of time. At a high level, what we're offering is, first of all, Public Interest Registry understands that it is a registry operator with respect to the NGO community, that it has to be a neutral third party, that while we are ourselves a not-for-profit and a member of the community, in offering this space, we cannot be positioned as some kind of central point authority who defines who is and who is not an NGO. That is not our role, and that is clearly understood. From that vantage point, how do we verify NGOs working with community data, whether it's lists or registrations or referrals or other mechanisms, is what we're piecing together so that we can have a verification mechanism that projects that sense of confidence that when I interact with an organization at a .ngo address, I'm dealing with a genuine NGO. And that is the trust benefit. That's the value for the community. And some of the things we've learned along the way in those interactions is looking at the global NGO community. First, for me, in doing a lot of workshops with grassroots NGOs, while maybe they are thinly staffed and maybe they aren't technically savvy, they understand the power of the internet. In workshops where we, in India, right during that day, got a number of NGOs online with a registered.org, a basic website, some training on how to use WordPress, they understand the power of the internet, they know they want to be on it, and they like the control of having a website and knowing how to maintain it themselves. We're very aware that there are other platforms out there. There's social media. There are ways that NGOs can get online in a cost-effective way, but the value of having a website that has this benefit of being a trusted space and that you can control in how you project your message, your mission, and how you interact with others is seen as critical. So those are other learnings that we've had along the way. In terms of the NGO community, looking at how services have been delivered to NGOs, a recognition that much of the effort to confirm that NGOs are bona fide or confirm that they're doing what they say they're doing with the dollars that are donated to them comes from the foundations down. Looking at those services, looking at those efforts, we see .NGO and ONG as creating a dynamic of the NGOs up, of creating a platform where the NGOs really are building that trust factor, projecting that trust factor, things that they can do on .NGO that will help verify that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing with their dollars, that the donors who want to connect with them can trust them, but creating almost a bottom-up kind of effort to enhance the trust space across the NGO community. And to Klaus's point, too, understanding that NGOs interact with each other, sharing information, sharing best practices, a critical learning for us along the way that, indeed, this is just an opening. This is a first platform. There's many things that we know will evolve as NGOs begin to use this space and with other organizations and entities, is sector, exactly. So we see all of that promise. What we need to do successfully at the outset is, as Public Interest Registry, offer this space in a way that serves the community, in a way that projects that trust, working with the NGOs to build it, and continue to be that neutral third party that we have been for org. And we know that organically with the NGOs' efforts, with the friends and other partners who are there to help build that community, this has great potential. Thank you.
I just wanted to add to that because we're deeply involved in the project as well. My name is Andrew Mack. Brian talked about the top-down and the bottom-up aspects, and I wanted to grab onto the side-to-side aspects of it. There is one of the things that we've seen through the research that's been done so far is just how much dynamism there is in the sector, but oftentimes how much leverage isn't being taken advantage of, not just in terms of best practice, but also in terms of things like groups coming together to work on larger projects that they all have in common. And this is one of the things that we've seen, whether it's applying for larger grants from groups like the World Bank and major foundations and things like that, or whether it's trying to find a partner in a new jurisdiction that you're trying to work in. Because one of the things is, as people will often tell you, whether it's disease or it's conflict or whatever, it's not problems don't stop at the border. And the work of NGOs don't stop at the border. And so we are in this kind of new world where, whether it's bird flu or it's political instability, you need to be able to address this across a region oftentimes. And one of the great excitements that I'm seeing about this project and what people are talking about a great deal is the ability to work on a regional basis, to come together, to leverage resources. Oftentimes you have corporates that are interested or foundations that are interested that wouldn't necessarily be able to find an individual NGO, which can find them and will be able to find them through this kind of a platform. So we see tremendous leverage effects that a lot of people are very excited about.
Thank you. Anyone, do you want to go ahead? Thank you.
Thank you. And so I guess building on that, myself, Edmund from .Asia, we are probably one of the NGOs that is running an existing TLD. And I can share a little bit about us, and then I'll talk a little bit about the new GTLD program. When .Asia was formed, actually, one of the interesting things was what created the environment for us to be sort of born is that in the Asia-Pacific region, the internet community has a very collaborative environment. AP NIC and many other organizations work very closely together. One challenge, though, was that there are lots of initiatives that want to be formed around Asia, the internet community, but funding is often a tough thing to do. The reason being, local initiatives, like if you want to do an internet initiative in China or in Japan or in Hong Kong or in Indonesia, locally, you have grants, you have government support and those kind of things. But when you want to do a regional initiative, there really isn't any grants funds, because if you want to get a grant, usually the government requires you to, you know, have the benefit within that particular region. So that was actually the background of when .Asia was formed. And .Asia, luckily, we are economically viable, but at that time, we are, you know, there was there was pushing, you know, how do we find the funding as well? And running .Asia allows us to plow back all the surpluses into community projects to promote internet development in Asia. And we're quite excited that since our launch in 2007-2008, it's been 5 years now, we're quite happy with the development, we have been able to actually help fund and support a number of initiatives in Asia, including the, as mentioned, including helping get the Asia-Pacific regional IGF started off the ground, because, again, if the first one is off, you know, first few couple is usually very difficult to get up, and you need to have funding, you need to have the coordination, and you need to have the coordination of the region. And that plays exactly into my point, is before this possible, you know, the possibility wasn't there, because a regional body is not always there. So, and also we've been able to put back the surpluses into supporting initiatives like One Laptop Per Child. So we're helping them expand into Asia, sending laptops to rural villages in China, in Cambodia, in Bhutan. We've been helping Creative Commons in Asia. We've been helping, we've been actually bringing young people to ICANN meetings and from Asia and to different Asia internet governance discussions. So these are, I guess, in terms of the impact, following from when Tony started off and being opportunities and from Klaus as well, and I really see this as a very good opportunity for NGOs running a registry. Always running a business is not always going to be making money, for lack of a better word, but there is an opportunity to make a economically viable platform which can then benefit the community as well. With that, I guess I move to sort of the new GTL, the current new GTLD process, and bring about another example. So the .Asia example was what I just mentioned, and we were able to help NGOs in that format. In fact, we are helping run as a secretariat for a number of Asia-wide initiatives right now, because a lot of these initiatives, when they start, they're not fully formed, right? And .Asia gives it a home, and we help them as a secretary. One of those, which is a new GTLD application that I want to talk, share about, is .kids. This is another very good example. .Asia has had the opportunity to support it through the program. And I think what Klaus mentioned in terms of building a community, this is exactly the type of an example, we hope a good example, of a new GTLD that is built around a community. And the .Kids Foundation is actually built as a new foundation that is a consortium of children's rights organizations and children's-led organizations. This is something that I learned in the last couple of years, helping them through the process, is that there are these organizations that are children-led. What it means is that these organizations have a board, and to get in the board, you have to be under 18, and to vote on the board, you have to be under 18.
It's too late.
so it's all too late for us. But it's in what is interesting is that through the process of getting dot kits together, two things become very apparent. One is that the kids community, obviously, I think everybody knows, starting from grade school or even earlier, they're online. They care about the internet. And what became very apparent is that because they are also involved in these children-led organizations, they're actually well-versed in policy. Believe it or not, but well, yes, they are very well versed in policy. But once they touch on, once they realize that internet governance and hear about the ICANN process, they are actually very excited. They did not know that they would be able to participate. And through the process, it allowed us to engage these children groups to tell them, This is a platform you can participate. Not only just participate in general policy, but participate in the policy of something they really care about, and they're on it basically 24 hours a day. Because they run a 38-hour day, based on the reports that I see. You know, because they're doing multiple things at one time, so they run a anyway. So I think. What is interesting is that the new GTLD itself, when it's cell.kids, it doesn't necessarily mean each kid have a .kid domain, but the initiative itself actually helps build the community, the global community, and also helps it with a flag or a beacon or allows them to come together around a cause. Rally around a cause, and one of the things that I think was not really mentioned about, which I think is quite exciting, is that actually a new GTLD, you know, it's not just about sometimes it's not just about selling names, nor is it just about a sort of technical name registered in database in the DNS. It's not just about that. It's very visible, and it acts as a flag to. So that the community can rally around a cause. And that cause for .kids is to bring about what they call the kids-friendly internet. And what I've been, again, educated about is that kids-friendly is not just about kid safety. And there's a big difference between that. And a couple good examples. One is Wikipedia is probably kids-safe. But the information could be very dense. It's not kids friendly, and imagine a Wikipedia.kids. It would be quite different from a Wikipedia.org right now. And that's the dream, and that's the cause. Because right now on the internet, there's tons of information, but not a lot of companies, not a lot of initiatives, have the mindset to have a kids-friendly version of their site, and .kids is about that. That's sort of the dream that they are building around. So it's kids safety. Kids safe is a basic. Kids friendly is the dream that is being built. And what is interesting, I always like to think that if it becomes successful, and just think about ICANN.kids, I would probably be reading the documents on that one rather than the 300-page document. So that's a vision, and I think this is part of the impact or part of the benefits that the new GTLD, possibilities that the new GTLD process can bring about. I did want to, and another important aspect that I sort of mentioned earlier on is the children participation. This allowed us them to bring together the children's rights organizations, to bring together the children organizations that are very keen about the internet, but we don't see them around here. We very seldom see them in internet governance forum either. But this initiative allowed them to now start participating, and which they didn't know they could, nor did before. So this is I guess part of the impact and part of the benefits that a new GTLD program could bring as well. I'll end with a couple of interesting observations of that too, but because the new GTLD program actually has some challenges for this type of initiative to build around as well. As a new organization, for example, they went through the applicant support program, for example, which is with the new GTLD program. But that's a pretty big challenge. As the results show, although you know we're very happy about it, that .kids did get it, but overall the program, you know, it was it's very challenging because if you look at the results, out of the 1,900 applications, only 3 actually decided to apply. There's a reason for that, I guess. Many others might be applying if the barriers weren't that high or it is not as confusing for the applicants. So that's one area. The other big challenge is going to be the difficulty in the community TLD evaluation process. Right now, .kids is in play, but they are against 2 Goliaths. One David against 2 Goliaths. Both Amazon and Google applied for .kids. So besides the, you know, the possible benefits, there are challenges with the, you know, how the new GTLD process is, and it's a very difficult process. I'm sure those around the table probably is aware. There's this 16-point process, and you have to get 14 points, which is close to impossible. We'll see how it pans out. But what is what would be very tough for NGOs is that, especially built around a community, is that it's very likely that you might be up against for-profit companies that have much better resources around it, and you know you might not be able to, well, quote unquote, beat them in the process. But that's you know, for .kids actually, even if they lose, even if they eventually did not get it, I think it is still the new GTLD program still brought about a couple of benefits. One is I believe that the group will, you know, let's say they lost to Google or Amazon, they would definitely be watchdog of how they will be running the .kid registry. And the other one is the ability is the benefit that is already happening, being able to bring them, bring those groups, those stakeholders really, to ICANN and have them participate at internet governance at ICANN, at IGF, and different fora. So those are, I guess, part of the sharing, and I think this is overall, one of the key messages I think is very interesting for new GTLDs is that it's not just a domain name, it's not just DNS. Because it's so visible, it could be a rallying cause for initiatives for NGOs as well.
Thank you very much, Edmund. Very interesting. Zaid, you're next, I believe.
Hi, I feel terrible. Because I'm going to spoil the party. let me start.
Sorry,
off.
That's why we left you the last
yeah.
one.
I figure now I get it. Well, let me start by saying, yeah, Edmund heard me yesterday, right? Is that right? Day before or something? So he knows most of what I might say. Let me start by saying that there are definitely benefits, and a lot of them have been sort of laid out this morning. And I will be focusing, and you can take what I say with a pinch of a grain of salt, because I come from the business constituency. Our views with respect to the new GTLD program are very much on record. We have serious concerns. We continue to have serious concerns with a whole bunch of things. And let me start, you know, by saying that, look, let's look at the situation where an NGO is not actually a new GTLD applicant. That's one thing I'd like to focus on. The other thing I'd like to focus on also is, you know, there are NGOs who have budgetary constraints, and there are NGOs who come from developing countries and particular circumstances. So, you know, having sort of preambled that in that form, in that narrow sense, not saying that this is completely wrong and, you know, we shouldn't have it, but certain concerns do come to mind. So, of course, it's a business opportunity. There's a possibility to monetize it, as .Asia has done. It can have great benefits. But also it means that you have to have the capital to be able to start it. It also means that then you're lucky enough that there are registrations within your new GTLD space, and then basically you are able to make money out of it. So, you know, if you were looking at a general NGO, say they weren't applying for new GTLD. What does the new GTLD program mean for them? It means that, let's frame it first. They have limited budgets. They're working on grants. Running and monitoring just the .com space with a TLD can be a challenge. Getting web hosting, making sure their website is up is a challenge. So, you know, the cost of admin, cost of budgetary constraints, and the fact that they always need help put them in a position where they aren't necessarily the best positioned when we have the sort of explosion of domain names that will take place. And as I say, especially in developing countries. Let me also sort of say that we should look at the people who are affected in three forms. Now, the business constituency, the IPC, do a great job of saying, you know, protect the brand holder. That is true for any NGO. NGO also has a brand. It's not a trademark, but it's definitely a brand. But there are two other components to this. There's the obviously the brand and goodwill holder, but there's also the end user confusion, because at the end of the day, people who get online want to be able to reach you, and whether they're confused about which website they've gotten to is an issue. The third is the registrant confusion. When you go as an NGO and you want to register, which TLD will you choose to register in? It's a decision. It's a very important decision. And I think Brian laid out very important reasons why you should do your research. But is that going to be obvious to most registrants in many other countries about which TLD they're going to register in? Just look at a domain name. Should they do the S or not the S? I mean, you know, there will be this problem that there will be TLDs, and this is something the board has made absolutely clear yesterday, saying that there is no visual confusion between health and healths. That's perfectly okay, and they will exist, and that will be fine. And according to them, that's not a problem. So which one do you go for? If you go for A or S, would you add an S at the end of it? And these are decisions that registrants are going to have to make at the second level. And also, if you were going to apply for a new GTLD, so I'm also going to add that in, do you also apply for the S just to defensively register? That means it's 185,000 plus another 185,000? Because you've got to get, I mean, there's WHO, there may be SOS, there may be AID, there may be others, and do they have to actually get the S as well? Now, these are things that may be ironed out, but we've heard very clearly from the board that they do not intend to do anything about this issue. So what that means for anybody else, not just NGOs, is a thing we need to consider. There's also the aspect of the IDN space. To what extent do IDNs function and do they work? And in the GNSO, there was a lot of sort of lively discussion. We had some folks from China actually make the point that IDNs, we have problems with them, because when you do register an IDN, there are variants. Variants meaning they look exactly the same. So the Chinese character, simplified and traditional, will look exactly the same. Does it mean we need to have both? Ram Mohan yesterday, or was it the day before, I think, Edmund, when we were in the room, also mentioned that there's a problem with email, because you don't have the keyboard. So when you reply, you can't actually, first of all, see the email address and then write the email address. These are things that need to be sorted out. But again, that's a narrow area, right? Okay? It's not ASCII. So let me come to the point that was made about, you know, whether there's a threat of cybercrime and malicious abuse within this space. I come from Pakistan. And a lot of money was collected during the earthquake and during the floods. And there were issues when it comes to cybercrime and cyber fraud. Similarly, you have the Olympics. The amount of cybersecurity that the UK put into trying to make sure they protected the Olympics brand is incredible. That's an NGO. So those issues, without the new GTLDs, are enormous, and they cost a lot of money. What's going to happen when you do go into these expanded namespace areas? And again, let's go back to a developing country situation. You know, there is a tax now. I mean, I'm not just talking about identity theft and the money being, you know, phishing attacks and things like that. But I'm talking about shutting websites down. Just the other day, my country is going through an election. The Human Rights Commission, which is not a government-owned body, it's an NGO, was attacked by a foreign hacker using an emblem of a foreign country, took it down, and then there was a backup by some other cyber hackers or whatever to try and bring it up again. Now, this is going to keep on happening. In the meantime, records for election, for where to go and vote, what the records of candidates were. All these things were in play. The Election Commission's own website went down. So, I mean, again, I'm in a narrow sense, those things that get very contentious, and they are NGO space, will require extremely... well, there will be an expenditure involved, a cost involved in making sure that we get that right. Now, what kind of protections can, say, someone who's not applying for a new GTLD, just has a domain name in the second level, what can he do? Well, he can do whatever, basically, a brand holder can do. They can try and get their name in to the trademark clearinghouse, okay, and say, well, here's my brand, I've registered it, I'm either protected by an international treaty, by a law, or something else, and so basically gets into the trademark clearinghouse. But what does that give you? The only thing that gives you is either protection at sunrise, and you got to pay for it, so it's again cost to an NGO, and then all you get as a benefit is a notice to the person who's going to register it, saying, "Oh, by the way, just to let you know, this might sort of conflict with an NGO's brand." That's it. And by the way, that protection only lasts for 60 days after launch. After then, it's wide open. So the question one would ask is, I as an NGO with limited funding, do I want to put my brand into the trademark clearinghouse? Does it give me a benefit with that limited protection? And then what do I do if I don't do that? Well, I do rapid suspension, and I have to pay every single time to take any sort of domain name in those TLDs down. Can I go to ICANN and say, listen, I've got a major problem. I'm Olympics, so I'm somebody else, and there's this massive abuse about me with my name. Well, you can under the post-delegation dispute resolution process or procedure. The only problem there is you're not a party, one. Okay, ICANN can decide how they want to deal with it in that arbitration. And the second is that it will only catch situations where you can prove affirmative action on the part of a registry, not omission, or not a lack of trying to take some kind of action. So, again, that's limited. So there are certain things that have been built in when it comes to really serious malicious abuse, though, you know, cybercrime. A registry is supposed to have certain policies for malicious abuse, rapid takedowns and suspensions. That was a really good thing. So something that's really, really obvious. You know, there's supposed to be an abuse point of contact for a registry. You contact them and say, well, okay, can you take it down? But imagine, who's going to make that call? Will the NGO do it? Does it have the money? Does it have to contact a lawyer to do it? Does the lawyer in that developing country even know who to call? Do they know that there is an abuse point of contact? At the moment, they're just struggling with UDRP. You know, what do I do? Do I go to my cybercrime guys in my police station, or do I go see a lawyer who has no idea about ICANN? Where do I go? I mean, they're still learning. So those are challenges, and I'm sure, you know, you can address them, I guess, with some sort of awareness, but, you know, it's not global necessarily yet. And we have a problem with contractual compliance. We've seen that. I know we're trying to ratchet it up. We're, you know, the ICANN's contractual compliance is supposed to get better. But we've continued to see that as a problem. And imagine with the explosion. You know, I don't think anybody expected this number of applications. Imagine the amount of contractual compliance staff and resource they were required to monitor this space. So it will come down to good registries, like, you know, .org, basically, they're the new .NGOs, providing, so what are the solutions? Providing high security zone TLDs, providing DNSSEC, providing good policies within their TLD space. So those are things one should work, you know, look at and say, well, that's where I want to be. I want to be in a place which is safer than anywhere else. Maybe I don't need to apply for my own. But again, there may be a cost associated to it. On the rest of the TLD, that's just where I am. What about the rest of the TLDs? Well, you're going to have to outsource. You're going to have to outsource the monitoring to somebody. That's going to cost you. Whether it's Mark Monitor or somebody else, it's going to cost you money to have people monitor and see, well, is there a phishing site somewhere? Just like they were doing for the Olympics, for instance. And you might have to tie up with search engines, social media, because if there's confusion about where you are or you want to get that message out, instead of trying to spend lots and lots of money trying to take down websites, maybe you want to pay the Google, you know, the search engines, the Yahoo's, the Google's, etc., or Bing, and say, give me preferential treatment when somebody does a search for something. So those are things you might have to consider. But again, by the way, just remember, all this costs money. But it's not perfect. If you're in China, you got to ask yourself, are you going to be blocked? If you're in Saudi Arabia, you have to ask yourself, will you be blocked in your search results? Because the search results in China and in Hong Kong are different, and the rest of the world, right? So you have to sort of, these are things that NGOs will have to consider, you know, whether they go into a TLD. The biggest risk I see for those who are in conflict zones or doing human rights stuff is going to be whether you're going to be in a TLD which can be completely blocked. So if I'm a government that wants to shut down a human rights TLD, I take everything down because now I've got one space and one attack target. That's it. I'm done. That was the argument for .XXX as well. If you want to get rid of pornography, everything will be .XXX, you're done. It's over. So does that mean, do I want to be in that just one TLD if I'm a human rights activist? No, I want to be in multiple places so that it's much more difficult for the government to try and attack me. So again, this is not true for everybody. This is not true for the World Bank, for instance, or IMF. But it is true for human rights activists or Amnesty International or people who want to use, you know, YouTube, et cetera. So what should you know, NPOC, for instance, consider? You know, you need to sort of work out what your issues are. Moving forward, there's a restructuring review of the NGO. You will have a place there. You will have a voting power. Whether you have concerns which align themselves with or you are aligned because of your own interests with other constituents, you need to consider. And to what extent, how do you move forward in what is currently a stalemate space within the GNSO? That's something I would sort of advise you to consider. And I think you have great opportunity to be able to make partnerships across different constituencies. Because, you know, say, for instance, the BC and IPC have similar concerns in this area. The other thing is, be ready. There is a review that is going to come up of the new GTLDs 18 months after launch. So that's an opportunity to be able to look at what's happened. I know it's not a massive period of time between launch, and there may be limited statistics, but you will have something to be able to go back with and say, well, maybe we can fix some of these things. How do we create space for ourselves? And I just want to end saying, again, all the concerns that I do raise may be narrow in their application and may not be true for every NGO, but they are true for some, and they are definitely true for developing country NGOs with cost issues. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. This is indeed very interesting. Maybe I would like to ask Poncelets if we have questions from our online participants. We don't. So I would like to open the floor for questions from our participants. We do have a question? Okay, Poncelet, please.
Thank you, Zaid and Edmund, for both your presentation, including Bran. One of the most important things that has occurred over the last couple of years, when we look at the overall ecosystem in development, is actually how do you identify what exactly is who is an NGO? Zaid, you talked about what happened during the crisis in Pakistan and with relief aid. And we also have a lot of challenges too that occur with where will young people get comfortable and stuff like that. But my question, all the points you raised are very valid points. They are the realities of our time. And we have our public interest guy, Brand, which .org has done brilliantly. There's no doubt about it. We now have .ngo coming up. And the biggest challenge with us in .ngo is not about it not going to be relevant, but how do we advocate the importance of it to our community? And that is the question. I don't know if Brian or anybody here can help me answer.
Thank you for that. So very soon in the coming months, Public Interest Registry will engage in what I've described as our second wave of outreach to the community in a very structured fashion. The first wave was really an outreach to the community to test the idea and get feedback as to whether or not the community said, this provides potential real benefit to me. And the answer was, honestly, across the board, a resounding yes. So we will be reaching out because we are anticipating the launch of .ngo and ONG in early 2014, if ICANN sticks to its current calendar. And so workshops, working with partners to get the word out. We have an expression of interest list that is now open, and we're publishing across all media and through any channels, and happy to work with partners to get the word out on that front so that NGOs can express an interest in a given string prior to the launch and build that awareness across the community. But that is a distinct task that we in our own shoes will begin to address, and so we're looking to find ways to amplify the message. And the message, you know, to go back to some of Saeed's points, and he raises a number of very, very important points, the single problem, this doesn't address all the problems, but the single problem we heard, Saeed, from NGOs was the problem of briefcase NGOs, the fraudsters who set themselves up. There's a hurricane, there's a flood, and suddenly well-intended dollars are taken and absconded. And the resounding yes from the community was, if you can provide a verified space so that it's genuine NGOs, bona fide NGOs, you're doing us reputationally a real service that we can build on. So what I'm getting to is the second part of how can we get the word out is, what's the message? So that's incumbent on us with you to clearly define what we think the benefit is. So that's the core of the benefit, that we can create a trusted space that is uniquely identified for bona fide NGOs. The other important part of that is that we know in building verification that we can find lists that we can use to identify, you are an NGO, so you can come into the zone. And let me be clear, we are not doing deep validation. Our test is a high-level one. Are you or aren't you an NGO? Is there some evidence, whether it's a registry list or some documentation or a referral from a bona fide NGO that we can rely on to say you're a good guy, you can come into the zone? But there are other pieces that make that work holistically. We're going to provide the community also with a mechanism to raise a red flag about a registrant. If a bad registrant has gotten into the zone, there has to be an active mechanism or mechanisms for the community to flag that. And there has to be a challenge process where evidence can be put forward, because it's not in our interest or the community's interest to have fraudsters in the zone, full stop. So when we talk about how to get the word out and what is the word is a trusted, closed.NGO space can elevate the entire community. But it has to be interactive. So part of the outreach will be bringing the message to the community and asking the community, what can you do? What resources do you have to provide those other aspects of verification and engage them? Because they have to be aware. They have to be watching. They have to be helping to make this a holistic solution. So in the coming months or two, we will have a more put-together, packaged expression of what is the benefit, what is the message we're bringing, and be gauging very, very actively in outreach. So we're looking forward to working with partners to do that effectively.
We have a question from Eduardo, a remote participant for Zaid. He wants you to please elaborate more about MPOX opportunities down the line once the new TLDs go live.
Let me just also add to something that Brian said. For all the reasons that I described, it becomes extremely important to make sure that you are in a trusted space. And so the sort of policies that particular registry has that you go are going to be crucial. And that is the reason, once you see a trend of NGOs within their community moving across to a certain trusted space, what you will find is that people will follow. Because everyone will say, well, this is why I'm here. You know, and the NGO space is pretty much a pretty solid community. It's not like a disparate, say, business community, which is slightly different. An NGO community really does talk to each other. So I think that having those sort of high zone, you know, TLDs or DNSSEC or better policies against malicious abuse, etc., will help. On the question Eduardo raises, I think I addressed some of that at the end by saying that you need to sort of prepare yourself with your positions both, and I think you will have different positions depending on what kind of which kind of not-for-profit organizations you have. So whether they are developing country or smaller ones with budgetary constraints may have different views, and then they may like more protection, etc., and want to say, look, you know, where do I fit into this? And there may be those that may say, look, I have the money available to me because I'm an international not-for-profit, etc., and you know, those positions have to be sort of drawn out. Once you have those positions, I think that you need to take active role and active participation in the GNSO. I think that will be an important area. What you might also want to consider, and I don't want to sort of burst anybody's bubble here, but in a sense what I'm thinking is, if you have the NPOC, which is those who are interested in policies as a users, then there's the not-for-profit registries. So who owns .health, for instance? If that is a not-for-profit, I'm not sure. I'm just guessing. It isn't currently. Yes, I know there's a lot of contention in that space. But say there was a .rights, which isn't basically one of an applied for string. But supposing if that was, would they be in NPOC or would they have their own constituency? And I think initially, obviously, there's very few. So they would remain in NPOC, and their views also would be important to consider. And then as you grow, I think you'll have to consider maybe whether you should also have a separate constituency for that. Because that's what's happening, I can tell you, for business. A lot of businesses and brands have also applied for registries for their own brands. And there's a brand registry constituency that is being formed within the contracted party house. So these are things I think you should consider. And I think you have a fantastic opportunity to participate in GNSO in the coming months after these things go live.
Thank you. Alain is next.
Thank you. Alain Béranger from NPOC. I have a comment for you, Zahid, about Olympic, International Olympic Committee. Maybe I was in the wrong space when I argued this, but frankly, I could not prove, although I had proven black on white, that the IOC in every country was truly a not-for-profit corporation. Facing 3-4 of my colleague professors, I was not able for them to make the difference between the not-for-profit nature of the National Olympic Committee and the once every 2 years Olympic Game Organizing Committee. So, of course, I just wanted to say that. Maybe times have changed and we will see. One comment I have for you, Brian, is I happen to be from Canada, and I know how you get to be an NGO in Canada. And there's two steps, and I'm using that as an example. A relatively quick step, especially if you use a lawyer, will get you a not-for-profit status in a matter of days. And that's the number that goes into the business development report of the World Bank. But to get the chance to issue a tax receipt for the money that's given to you takes more like 18 months. And that happens to be the Canadian case. Now, how is it in New Jersey? How is it in Egypt? I don't know. So I know that you need to master your plan, but have you got some public direction of where you're going with this issue, and also the fact that the things can change in the country, like being an NGO 8 years ago in the Liberal government. And being an NGO today, after eight years of Conservative government, is not the same thing.
Yes, we are surveying a wide swath of countries to determine, just as you say, in Canada, there's a registration process or a legal process to become an NGO. There's a tax process, and we're doing a wide survey of countries, Northern Hemisphere, Southern Hemisphere, and the first thrust and the easier possibility is the list-based or the registry-based that are available, that are open, that we can rely on, that they are viable or authoritative in some way? And all of those questions require some examination. You can't just take things on face value. But there's clearly a good universe of registration-based or list-based sources that could be relied on to check whether or not a registrant is identified as an NGO on a list. Getting beyond that, if there's an NGO that's not on a list, and clearly, you know, there are many, many grassroots NGOs around the world are not going to be on these lists, that's the second piece of the puzzle. And so we know there's going to be a manual-based process which will require more resources and rely on other forms of evidence or documentation, and it varies country by country. And it's a bit more costly to build that part of the mousetrap, if you will. But those are the two fundamental building blocks of a verification process that we can rely on. And again, it's we can't just stop there. We can do our best to build that piece, but there has to be post-registration community tools to raise a red flag. We know the community is very active and talks to each other and looks out for its best interests. And then the ability to exit a bad guy who gets in. That being said, where we are now, it's clear to me that there aren't the sources to build a complete global 100% verification process. Let me be clear about that. We know that. And so we are thinking through going to market with the best built reliable verification platform with the community interaction tools, with the challenge process, but how can we engage the community, because this is the only way we can do it, to build out the rest of that verification tool? And that squarely is the question mark in front of us. How can we work with the community to fill in that gap so that truly, whether it's a year from now, 2 years from now, 5 years from now, we can say, yes, we can validate any NGO who comes to apply for an address. And that's where we are in our process.
Oh, sorry. My bad. I was just going to add a tiny bit, just a small bit, which is that we also recognize that this is not a, it's not a one-time shot it's not a snapshot. That this is in fact a flow. And so part of the mechanism that Brian is talking about involves being able to go back to people who are in the community on a biannual basis or something like that, just to make sure that they're still active as NGOs, again, to raise the level of confidence within the community.
Thank you. Klaus is next.
I want to come back, Ponsele, to your question, and which neatly ties into what Brian just said. Ponsele, you asked the question, how can we transmit, or how can .NGO transmit the significance of the new GTLD? And I think the question, in a way, you asked was the wrong person. I think as .NGO is a tool for the NGOs, it's also the responsibility of the NGOs to get the word out. We have to do our part too. We just can't go and say, okay, .NGO, you do all the work for us. I think we have to take over some responsibility and some of the initiative. Of course, in close cooperation. That brings me exactly again back to the validation part. We can't expect and say to .NGO, now you find the perfect model and you do it. We have to contribute from our part to it. And I just would like to throw, and I pointed into that direction before, but I think it's also significant. It's not only outreach to tell to the significance of the to the ONGs or NGOs. What is important is also at the same time to go to the private and to the governmental sector and say, here is a game changer at hand. For example, if you want to have the lists of registered things, you have to go to the government and say, this is such an important tool for you in the future. Cooperate with us. Help us. And I think there is so much, again, there is so much potential. And to the private sector, I explained before, I mean, just in the sector of corporate social responsibility, what a game changer is .NGO. And to come back, and I really hope that also NPOC, and I severely hope that GKPF can really help to give the message out and saying not to our clientele but also to the other sectors, this is where the show is.
Thank you, the gentleman over there, and then Ponsulit.
Thank you very much, Satish Babu from the Computer Society of India, for the transcript. First of all, the complexity of the definitions, I completely acknowledge and agree. I've been working with NGOs for the last 30 years, but right now for the last 2 years, I've been working under a label of a government NGO, an oxymoron, but a civil society organization set up by the government, 100% funded by the government, registered as an NGO, but administered by me, who's been appointed by the government. So there are all kinds of variety in the labels that we can think of defining NGOs. The next point is that NGOs right now, this is mostly with regard to vis-a-vis what happens in India, do not seem to have any policy on electronic assets, including the domain names. They're completely fragmented. They have .org, they have .org.in, they have .in. They're all over the place. And therefore, there is no visible policy for most of them that they follow right now, as of now. However, there is a realization that, you know, almost like NGO 2.0, like the Web 2.0, that when you look to the future, that many NGOs think that there needs to be a kind of focus and a policy on how they should be treating the electronic assets, including domain names. However, the problem here is when you project something like .ngo in the context of a country like India, where there is enormous pluralism, is that the NGOs are likely to say that, are you forcing us to come under this label? In which case, we do not want to, because they fiercely value their independence, and they do not want to be coerced into any label, which they think is not necessarily, and it's not from the point of view of single label that can be kind of, you know, censored or blacked off. It is because they do not want to be perhaps kind of painted with one brush, and they value their independence. That's the other point. And I see that in a place like India, which is fairly complex, the only way to handle this problem would be to have a community validation process, as has been mentioned here earlier. The challenge is to look at a mechanism that is grassroots level, representative, participative, sufficiently responsive to kind of consider these applications and then validate them. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
So I just want to make a point. I mean, I run an NGO also in Pakistan, so it's we have challenges trying to register NGOs sometimes in certain countries because of the requirements. When financial aid is being given, and I don't know how they're going to work this out within sort of the ICANN space for financial contributions for new GTLD applicants, I think you'll see that the rule says you can have a mixture of having a private sector NGO sort of combination as well. They recognize that not all places have the same sort of a construct. And I can tell you that in order to, in my country, for instance, start basically working as a not-for-profit, the easiest thing to do is register a company, even though you basically say that you're not going to be distributing funds, etc. The trouble is, it's not technically, under that legislation, a not-for-profit. It may not have the exemption, etc. But the problem is that I'll give you an example. In order to be able to register an NGO in my country, the file goes right up to the chairman of the SEC. That's just a problem in itself, and then you have to get the renewal done. So keeping that in mind, I just wanted to sort of suggest that, you know, have that flexibility in there. Thanks.
Thank you. The lady over there? I don't remember your name.
Hi, Jennifer Knoll, San Francisco Bay ISOC, and also Doc Green. Actually, Andrew answered my question. I was just curious to know how you would keep the list up and make sure that... and I was... just curious how you felt about liability issues with regard to determining whether or not someone was verified to receive an .ngo. Like, if you were feeling at all concerned about being liable, held liable in some way, or it's probably not relevant, but just a thought that I was wondering.
We have a general counsel. So those questions are clearly addressed. We are looking at the questions of lists and viability of lists and how often they are refreshed and what are the criteria that we need to rely on so that a list can be relied on. So that's part of the calculation, clearly. But we do think it's important to provide the community the mechanisms to assist us as well. We don't view this as a holistic verification without those elements, without the challenge process, without the ability for the community to red flag and bring bad actor evidence to bear. Those are critical. And they're critical not just from the liability standpoint. We submitted this as a community-based application. This is not PIR building something in a vacuum. We had many, many workshops and did lots of outreach, including in India, and got very good feedback consistent with your points. This is truly a community-based application. This is truly an invitation for input and collaboration with the community to make sure this works. We have a fair understanding of the politics of the NGO community and how sharp they can be. And so we have to walk a fine line of being a trusted, neutral third party, using the best source data, interacting with the community, giving the community a role. And we think if we do that well, then it's going to be the right solution. So that's kind of our approach and our math.
I just want to say thank you, and it's inspiring to know that you're going to that effort, and hopefully the rest of us can benefit from it somehow. Thank you.
Thank you. I believe Klaus, you next.
Yeah, I just put another hat on, and the hat is as a board member of a foundation in Latin America. And the situation in Latin America in some countries is quite simply if some of my fellow NGOs in the country would use any kind of complaint service available or reject against my foundation, quite simply because it's a business. And as less and as more foundations I can take out of business or out of the NGO space, as better it is for my business. I'm not complaining about that practice because that is human, but I think it points us a little bit in the direction where maybe the solution should be. I think at the end, the defining body or function needs to stand above that level, and it needs to be above the community, but from the community. Because otherwise we will have all kinds of shenanigans and tactics going on. And I think that's where the solution will be, and I'm fairly certain that with all, as we got the GTLD sorted out, we will sort out .ngo and how that one works.
Thank you. Alain, you're next.
Thank you. Again, 8 years ago, this question about the robustness of the Canadian-wide NGO alliance I would never have thought of raising this. And then I see 8 years of Conservative government, and I mean, I'm not against everything a Conservative government does, but what I have noticed is that the funding of that institution is a good part of it, of which came from the government, has been reduced. I am not in the Prime Minister's head. I don't know what's going on in his head. But I just want to back up his argument, because the country he's talking about is in a dire strait compared to Canada. But it does raise the issue that he mentioned of having a body who was financially robust enough that they can do that check-in and check-out, unless you have somebody moving around and checking the files. So you probably have thought about that, but I just wanted to raise it, because it's something I wouldn't even have thought of in Canada 8 years ago.
Ponsulitz.
Thank you, Marilo Ponsulitz. Again, I just want to share a brief experience. And when we look at Eduardo's last question on verification of MPOC's role in helping to verify NGOs, the Gambia is a touristic country. You know, most of its the income, apart from peanuts, is tourism. And what tourism has also brought to the country, people coming for holidays and meeting people on the beaches who tell them that, oh, I have to build, I have in my village, my auntie has a small garden farm, I'm doing this and this. And they are normal guys on holidays or normal women, and they say, okay, we'll help you out. And people started... This has been happening ever times in, with the tourism sector, and later all the NGO community said in the Gambia, including the YMCA, Action Aid, SOS, they all came up and said, there's something wrong here, because we go to a community and we want to do something, and at the end of the day, something has been half done because some... As they used the word, some white man came and started this project, and it has disappeared. And he asks, this is the boy, who brought him. What happened? Oh, he didn't send more money. And so all the angels said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to put it out there. If to all the communities in the country through the NGO Affairs Tango, that if anybody wants to do any donation, you know, you want to work with schools, you want to do stuff on adolescent reproductive health, if you don't, you come to the country, you don't want to talk to the Action AIDS or the YMCA, and maybe you are American or you're British, or you have development agencies that work directly in communities. Go to the Peace Corps, for example. Peace Corps volunteers have been in Gambia forever. They have data on what interventions and what, because since they are all over, they have the Peace Corps office, they have those data of community-based NGOs that get funding from the bigger ones. They will be able to verify who is doing what in that community. You go to the volunteer service organization and stuff like that. So basically, I started thinking when I'm hearing all this verification stuff, and I want us to remember that we have the big NGOs who walk down a certain layer, like whether it's Action Aid or Oxfam. But at the same time, they're not really NGO, they are international development agency like Peace Corps, like VSO, who have have credibility in putting foot soldiers, as we call them, that aid the development process. And we shouldn't forget that community in helping us use them for the verification processes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mac?
Okay, Andrew Mack, to a couple of points that have been made, because I think they're both excellent points. To Alain's point, you mentioned the fact that the government was cutting budgets, and I think this is a real and significant factor around the world. As we go through the changes in corporate finance and government finance, places all around from Europe to the United States, this is going to be a factor of our future. However, one of the things that's happened with the internet is the incredible diversification and democratization of funding. And what we're finding more and more is that individuals are able to fund initiatives. And Ponsulitz, you mentioned this vis-a-vis the Gambia, and I think it's a very important point. There are literally millions of donors in a place like the United States. How are they going to find a charity or an NGO in the Gambia? That's the thing. And so one of the pieces of this initiative that we think is so powerful is exactly that they might, through a .NGO, be able to say, okay, I don't even know where the Gambia is. I certainly couldn't go to the Gambia. It would be cost prohibitive for me to go there, set up shop, learn all the things that I would need to learn. But through a .NGO, I might be able to find partners on the ground. I would know that they are real. We might, and you mentioned the idea of working with people who are already working on the ground. Part of the verification process that we're working on is there's part of it is looking through lists, but part of it is also working through people who are on these lists who already have a track record and allowing them to also nominate local NGOs such that we capture not just the what they call the bingos, the big international NGOs, right, but also the people who are on the local level who are doing good work, right? And so you've got these two things happening simultaneously. One is tremendous numbers of people, and there's a lot of wealth in personal hands, in private hands now, right? Not all of which needs to go through a major foundation. People who can give $100. $100 to a project in the Gambia, you need five of those. You've got a project, right? So this is a very powerful thing, but they would have to find you, and they would have to trust you. And this is part of the dynamism that we see in this space. And in terms of government funding, a lot of what we're seeing, whether it's USAID or CEDA or what's left of CEDA or whatever is going to happen, right? What we're seeing is that the development agencies are changing their role from being full-stock implementers to seeing themselves more as catalytic sources, right? They're trying to leverage corporate resources. They're trying to leverage personal resources and foundation resources. And this is yet another way that we can use the internet for that.
Thank you, Andrew. Do we have any other questions? Oh, there is a remote. Then Zaid, yeah. Please. Maybe the remote participant, then Zaid, and the lady over there. Young lady.
I don't have a question, but I want to share with you about the situation here in China. Just now I heard your examples about the NGOs in your own country. And here in China, the situation is quite different, as you might notice or not. I would like to give you some brief introduction. A lot of NGOs here we might properly refer it as public institutions or public service units. And we have different type of that. Some are fully funded by the government, some are partially funded by government, and some are not funded by government. And they have close relationships to the government since they have to go through some procedures to get approved. For example, by Ministry of Civil Affairs or Civil Affairs at different levels. Also, we can see that about their functions, sometimes they are not only public service units, they can also have the public administrative functions. That is what the government should do. And the Chinese government is trying to put forward a reform to further classify these PSUs or NGOs you might have referred to. This might take a quite long process. So for those who you want to register TOD for NGOs and you want to target that to the Chinese PSUs and public institutions, it's quite important that you get to know the situation here. I'm from CONEC, and we also applied for two applications. One is gongyi.tod. That is, in English, it means public interest, and we are going to accommodate the Chinese communities globally. We are going to accommodate those who are going to serve the public interest purpose. What we are doing that in China, because we are running a test bed here for several years, we try to cooperate with the governments, with different ministries to get the approval that to see these registrants or these end users, whether they are certified by the government as the NGOs or public units. But once we get approved and being added to the root zone, we need to reach out to the global community and we need to cooperate with other regions, with other registries. The reason I'm here today to listen to the MPOC discussion today is that we really want to learn from MPOC what are the smart moves or the successful mechanisms the other regions they have and they can share with us. Also, CONEC is willing to cooperate with those registries or TOD applications that you are going to serve here in China. Okay, thank you.
Klaus, then our remote participant, please.
Thank you very, very much for this very important contribution, and I'm sure that Alain and others from NPOC are more than happy and glad to follow up with you. You actually stung directly into a very, very big wasp's nest. Because, for example, we are exactly in the same situation with NPOC. Think about, we can't register any Chinese NGO in NPOC because the statutes, as they are written, it's impossible for a Chinese NGO to fulfill the requirements. There is something wrong in the ICANN statutes for constituencies and things like that. On the other hand, then the next wasp's nest is does the eventual list of .NGO becomes a binding list for NGOs, definition and things like that, which then becomes a state function, basically. And so I don't want to even go there, but to repeat, somebody or we all will talk to you about how we can help you. And secondly, there is an internal housekeeping problem here in ICANN about who can actually become a NPOC member.
Thank you. I believe there's already a meeting that has been arranged between CONAC and NPOC. Will take place soon. But I think, can we take the question from the remote participant that has been waiting for a while?
Sorry, it was not actually a question, it was a comment on Zaid's intervention. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, Alain, then, if you want, please.
Alain Béranger from NPOC, for the record. Yes, we were approached by Yang Li about 3 weeks ago to organize a meeting here in Washington, and I'm so glad that you came to the meeting and explained the situation. So yes, 540 million consumer and users in China should be enough arguments to look at regulations, and I mean we do change our charters as the environment changes, and I'm so glad that Kathy is here because you have heard the argument, and the argument right now is if we do a black and white interpretation of our rules, we wouldn't be able to acquire CONAC as a member of the non-commercial stakeholders group, but I think that's part of business, and I think we have an environment now in the non-commercial stakeholders group where and NPOC's arguments, if they put them first, will be listened as well as if they were put forth by other colleagues from the community. So I welcome our meeting today and looking forward to discussing with you some of the details. Thank you.
Thank you, Alain. Gentleman over there, Satish is your name? Before you start, I think that Brian has to go, so I would like to thank him for his important presentation. It was very nice of you to be here with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much.
Satish, please.
Thank you very much. Satish Babu from India. I'd like to point out that the phrase non-governmental organization has a history, and it is a rhetoric from 30 years back when institutions wanted to be away from the government because government was considered as corrupt and inefficient and unresponsive 30 years back, and civil society organizations. This is a interpretation that we have in India because we also have a part in the generation of this label. Now we have to be sensitive to the origins. Although today the interpretation is widely different, we're not saying that we are against the government anymore. However, there is this issue that there are categories of organizations, for example, non-commercial organizations or civil society organizations or non-governmental organizations. These are actually labels which overlap, but they mean slightly different things. Now, the issue of China, which has been brought up, and also in some cases, the new generation organizations, civil society organizations, in many countries, do not follow the label of non-government, in the sense of they do not the non-government accentuates the difference between us and the government. That's what the label says fundamentally. So I think we have to keep in mind that we will be excluding a bunch of organizations which are perhaps .CSO, civil society organizations, by calling ourselves .NGO. Just a thought. Thank you.
Just very quickly.
Klaus is my co-chair.
NPOC doesn't stand for NGO. It stands for not for profit. That is, I think, very important. We have to, from time to time, remind ourselves to that one.
Do we have another comment or question? We do.
It's Andrew, for the record. Just to respond to what you said, one of the things that we've seen is around the world, what it means to be and what people call NGOs are different. And so the entire community needs to be sensitive to that. We are sensitive to that. In Bangladesh, you don't call NGOs at all, except if they're major internationals. And we recognize that there are many, many terms for what are effectively the same thing. The goal is to capture all of the good people as much as possible and to create a structure that's going to be supportive for them.
Thank you. Rudy? And then Kathy.
Yeah, sorry for being late. I just arrived. I would like to pick in on what...
I just want you to say your name. So
I'm Rudy Vansnik. I'm the interim treasurer of ANPOC and sitting on the policy committee. I want to pick in on what you were saying. I think it's good that we make a clear definition of the reason why we are there and for who we are there. As we say, the NGOs, everybody talks about NGOs, we have IGOs, we have so many structures in the world, and at the end, they are all doing the same work. They are not there for the profit, they are there for the profit of the community, but not for the profit of the business. And I think that's something we have to clarify in the charter, that ANPOC stays for the not-profit, which is a very clear group. And in the beginning, I also had a difficulty to understand what is the difference between NCUC, ANPOC, NCSG. At the end, it's all the same. We are all struggling to have the defense for the user. And at the end, no matter what name we have the same goal. And I think it's good that we could work together, close together, and have the same ambition in order to obtain what the user needs, his or her domain name registered, which is their property.
Thank you. Kathy?
Kathy Kleiman, I don't know what hat I'm wearing, so let go back very far, and I can. Forgive me for coming in late. I came in a little earlier than Rudy, but not much. I'm hearing a lot of different words, and I'm not quite sure what the overlap is, and I don't know what this is, whether this is the time to discuss it. I just thought I'd raise it. NGO, MPOC, governments, business units that often have nonprofit foundations and organizations. I heard Hartmut Glaser say something very interesting in some session, I don't remember where. Hartmut Glaser is one of the founders of CGI.br, the Brazil multi-stakeholder group. And he said that under, I guess, the equivalent of .org.br, they had created rules that restricted the types of nonprofits to those that were not organized for businesses or for business goals, but specifically for what we kind of traditionally consider nonprofit goals. So maybe I'm being too much of a lawyer, but I think of different categories. Governments are, of course, nonprofit, but they're governments, and they're operating for something different. So if someone's donating money to an NGO, they might not be happy to know that they were donating money to a government. There are these different categories, and I don't know how we deal with all of them. but there's certainly an issue there, and obviously within the ICANN world, different places for different types of groups, getting blurrier and blurrier.
Said?
Yeah, so the not-for-profit objective or category, and then the mission and the purpose are extremely crucial. And then there's also the fact of, I think, what the issue of the government is the independence issue. It's the governance aspect and independence. Now, if you have money coming from a government, that's fine. International governments have money they give across border to NGOs in other countries. That's also government money. The question is, to what extent is that money used in an independent fashion, and there's a governance mechanism to ensure that independence maintains? I think that's the key.
Kathy.
Sorry, just to add, I wrote down the three things, the nonprofit category, the mission and purpose, and the independence. I think that's very useful. I had never heard it quite that way. I think that's a very useful way to think about it. Thanks.
So do we have any more comments or questions? Andrew? No? Done? We're done. Okay. So I think that was a very interesting debate. We're almost done. It's 5 minutes before nine. What I would like to say is sort of sum up what we've been discussing. We heard about the benefits and challenges, and we heard among the category of benefits, we heard about community building and the fact that the new GTLD program would allow communities to come together around the cause. And also we heard about the fact that it would be a program that would help improve participation among NGOs and activists. And also we heard a lot about the fact that it would provide a trusted environment, the .NGO spaces, provided that the mechanisms, the validation and authentication mechanisms, the right ones are exist, and they're actually working on that. But these mechanisms have to be established together with the NGO community. That leads us to a big challenge that exists, is the cyber fraud, and it's already happening. We heard examples in Pakistan and other countries, and also some of the challenges are different labels among the NGO community, different realities that these NGOs are facing. We heard example in China, India, and that adds complexity to the debate, of course. And some of the other challenges we heard about are IDNs and all the variants and the fact that all issues are not solved yet. And also the costs that are going to be associated to the fact that there are new GTLDs and that the NGO community as such is most of the time facing financial constraints. And finally, the issue of the blocking, the censorship for some NGOs in some countries based in some specific regions that might oblige these NGOs to use multiple spaces within the online world so that they can avoid being blocked and censored. So with that, I would like to wrap up the session, thank all the speakers for being with us, having been with us, for their important presentation that has been very interesting, thanking the public for sharing these couple of hours with us, and I think Alain wants to say something.
Yeah, actually, thank you for closing the meeting. So this is post workshop. We just learned yesterday that peer.org and other donors will fund a one-day workshop in Durban and a one-day workshop in Buenos Aires about the role of civil society in building capacity for the DNS sector, respectively in Africa and in Latin America. So I just wanted you to be the first group of 20 people to go and spread the word. Thank you for doing that.
Thank you. We can stop the recording now. Thank you. Oh, well, another ad, now that you add that. Tomorrow afternoon, we are having a session on the role of youth in the DNS sector. So, and we are going to have a lot of several representatives from the .Asia and .Kid community. So you are invited to come in. Thank you. From 2 to 3:30. Thank you.